Usually when we talk about learning something completely new, there's this expectation of starting with the visible stuff. Like, think about building a house.
Right, you want to look at the walls going up.
Yeah. You see the windows being installed, the paint color. You want to see the immediate, tangible results of your labor.
It makes complete sense. I mean, human beings are wired to want to see what we're dealing with right away. We want that framework we can touch.
But then you step into the world of theology and philosophy, and suddenly you can't just look at the walls. You actually have to dig down into the dirt.
No,
You have to
absolutely.
pour a foundation so deep that it almost feels like you are going backwards before you can ever start going up.
Yeah, it is the absolute definition of starting from the ground zero of reality. Like, you have to interrogate the very dirt you were building on.
And that is exactly the journey we are embarking on today. Welcome, the learner, to a brand new series specifically designed for you. If you are completely new to Islamic philosophy, well, you are in exactly the right place. Our mission for this deep dive is to explore Treatise 1 of a foundational text by the great 20th-century Iranian philosopher Alaa-Akmeh Tabatabai. And this treatise is a step-by-step, meticulously guided journey into the concept of Tawhid, which translates to divine unity.
Right, and Alaa-Nasmeh Tabatabai builds a remarkably precise architecture here. If we connect this to the bigger picture, he is laying down a hard rule. We cannot talk about God's unity until we prove existence itself.
Okay, wow.
And once we establish that, we still cannot talk about God's absolute transcendence until we actually grasp what that unity truly means. It's a ladder.
Step by step.
Exactly.
Wow.
Every single step rests entirely on the integrity of the one right before it.
So I want you to just settle in. We're establishing a warm, curious, and inviting space today for what is, frankly, a truly mind-bending philosophical journey.
Yeah.
And just to set the tone, the text actually opens with a traditional praise formula, a blessing on the prophet and his household.
Yeah, which is super important context.
Right. Because in this tradition, that's not just a polite introduction, it is the signal. It means the throat clearing is over and the real work has begun.
I love that. It is literally the starting pistol for the intellect.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Before we can even begin to talk about a creator, Alaa-Nasmeh Tabatabai says we have to prove that anything exists at all, which on the surface sounds a little absurd.
It really does.
I mean, I'm sitting here, you're sitting there, but he stages this brisk, almost theatrical standoff to kick things off.
He does, yeah. He brings in two classical archetypes, the sophist and the philosopher. So the sophist enters the stage and essentially says, "The world is entirely empty. Reality is an illusion."
Just a total blank.
Right. Everything you see, feel, and think is a mirage.
The ultimate skeptic, like the guy who argues we might just be brains in a vat.
The absolute skeptic. And then the philosopher replies with a very simple counter. He says, "No, there are actual realities existing outside the mind." Now, Alaa-Nasmeh Tabatabai admits the philosopher's bare claim isn't a fully fleshed out argument yet. But he points out that we have no choice but to side with the philosopher.
Because of language, right?
Exactly. Words like real, actual, and existence must carry meaning. If they are just empty sounds, human language collapses.
Right. I mean, we can't even have a conversation about the illusion without relying on the concept of reality.
Precisely.
So once we agree that existence is a genuine, undeniable reality, Alaa-Nasmeh Tabatabai performs what feels like a philosophical magic trick to prove that existence has no second.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
I was looking at the notes on this, and I want to try out a plain English analogy to see if the logic actually holds up to scrutiny.
Oh, I love analogies. Let's test it. Walk me through it.
Okay, so if I try to imagine an other standing entirely outside of existence, that other must either exist or it doesn't.
Okay, tracking with you.
If it exists, well, then it's actually inside existence. It's part of the whole. But if it doesn't exist, then it's literally nothing. Therefore, existence has no outside. It cannot possibly have a second.
That is the exact mechanism of the argument. Anything you propose as an alternative to existence would, by its very definition, be void.
It's just nothing.
Right? It would be non-existence. You cannot have two existences separated by something because, well, what would separate them?
Right, what's in the middle?
Exactly. Non-existence. Non-existence is nothing. It cannot act as a boundary.
So the unity we are talking about here is not a unity like counting apples. Like it's not one apple, and maybe later we'll find a second apple.
No, not at all. The Arabic term he uses is wata aqwa. It translates to a true unity. And this is meant to be heavily contrasted with boring numerical unity.
Right.
Think about it. If you say one tree, you are just sticking a numerical label onto a specific kind of thing.
Which implies there's a second tree somewhere.
Exactly. It inherently implies the possibility of a second or a third tree.
Yeah.
You are imagining the empty space where the second tree could go.
Yeah.
But pure existence cannot be counted like that because there is no empty space outside of it.
Because the only thing outside of existence is non-existence.
Boom. And here is where the concept locks into place. Pure existence is the absolute opposite of non-existence.
Yeah.
They are simple, mutually exclusive opposites, like presence and absence. Because pure existence has no mixture of non-existence in it whatsoever, it cannot fail to exist.
It's essentially allergic to non-existence. Like, it has no capacity to not be.
That's a great way to put it. Philosophers call this the necessary existent. Furthermore, because every genuine perfection we can think of, like being alive or knowing or having power, is just a manifestation of being real, this necessary existent possesses every possible perfection.
And is totally free of defect.
Entirely free of all defect.
Wait, let me make sure I'm following the lead here from existing to perfection. Why does being pure existence mean having no defects?
Because a defect is just a lack of something. It is a type of non-being.
Oh, like a shadow.
Sort of. Think about blindness. Blindness is not a thing. It is the lack of sight. Weakness is the lack of power. Ignorance is the lack of knowledge.
Right.
If God is pure unmixed existence, he cannot contain any lacks. He cannot contain any non-being. Therefore, he is pure perfection.
Wow. Okay, but establishing that God is this pure, unbounded existence leaves us with a massive linguistic problem.
It definitely does.
If God is unbounded reality, how do our tiny, limited human brains even talk about him? We're transitioning here from the fact of existence to the limits of our own concepts.
This is a crucial pivot in the text. What is so fascinating about Ale Asmatabatabai is how he unpacks the idea of delimitation.
Delimitation.
Yeah. Every single concept we use in language limits a thing. If I use the word horse, I am inherently saying not a tree and not a mountain. Every concept draws a boundary.
Okay, I have an analogy for this. It's like trying to put a standard 3x3 yellow sticky note on the entire universe.
Oh.
The sticky note is always smaller than the universe.
I love that visual. The sticky note is a fantastic way to understand what he calls a posterior concept.
Posterior meaning it comes after.
Yes, exactly. You are attaching the sticky note after the universe already exists.
Right.
The universe doesn't shrink to fit the note, and the universe doesn't need the note to be the universe. In the same way, God is logically prior to every concept we might try to apply to him.
So even the good ones.
Yes. We say he is living or wise or powerful, and those are true things to say about him from our perspective, but God himself stands entirely beyond those labels. The labels are just our mental sticky notes limping after him.
But hold on, what does this mean for the big philosophical terms we use to show respect? Like, we call God absolute to signify that he has no limits. Are you saying calling him absolute is also a sticky note?
This brings us to the ultimate climax of Al-Ale Asmatabatabai's philosophical argument. And he literally writes in parentheses in the text, reflect carefully here.
Oh, so pay attention.
Yes. God transcends every concept, including the concept of being transcendent.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Think about the rule, God is unbounded. That rule is still just a human concept. It's a mental category you constructed.
So God is beyond that very ruling.
He is bound by no qualification whatsoever, not even the qualification of being absolute. Because if he were trapped by the requirement to be absolute, that would be a limitation. He would be restricted by your linguistic definition.
That genuinely breaks my brain a little bit. It's a complete paradox.
It's meant to push your mind to the limit. Yeah.
But if God is entirely beyond all labels, like beyond even the label of being beyond labels, yeah, then how do we make sense of the transmitted spiritual text?
The religious text, yeah.
Right, because we have the Quran, which literally gives God dozens of names. He calls him the creator, the sovereign, the merciful. How do we reconcile pure philosophy with those texts?
Well, the transition from pure logic to the text requires us to look at how the Quran repeatedly talks about God's absolute ownership. It frequently states, to God belongs whatever is in the heavens and the earth. But Al-Ale Asmatabatabai introduces a spiritual diagnosis here to explain it.
The diagnosis.
Yeah, he argues that if you actually turn away from worldly distractions, if you stop chasing prestige, wealth, lineage and power, which the text dismisses as mere play and diversion, then your perception clears and you will realize what those verses about ownership actually mean.
Okay, I gotta stop you there and push back on the word ownership, because that word carries a lot of baggage.
Fair enough. What do you mean?
When I hear ownership, I think of legal paperwork, like a cosmic landlord holding a deed to the earth.
Right, right.
But human ownership is an invention, right? It's a social convention that we all just agree to honor. So if the things of this world, the wealth and the status, are essentially just a stage play until what the text calls the decreed matter arise, then how do we understand God's names like sovereign or creator? Because he's not signing legal documents.
That is the perfect distinction to make. Alaleshme Tabatabai synthesizes this beautifully by stating that these names are not extra features glued onto God's essence. They are not job titles.
Okay.
They are what he calls real relations, as opposed to the conventional relations you just described.
Break down a real relation for me.
So in a conventional relation, like you owning a car, you and the car both exist independently. You just have a legal tie.
Yeah, we're separate things.
But in a real relation, one side depends completely on the other for its very existence. The names are the modes through which our essences depend on God.
Oh, I see.
He isn't managing us from afar like a CEO looking at a spreadsheet. His ownership is the very standing by which we are. Without his sustaining presence, our entire substance would vanish in an instant.
So the names aren't actually telling us what God is in himself behind the curtain. They are telling us how we relate to him. They map out our total moment-to-moment dependence.
That's a brilliant way to phrase it. They describe the architecture of our need rather than the architecture of his essence.
Okay, this all sounds incredibly abstract and deeply philosophical.
Yeah.
It begs the question, how did the earliest figures in Islam actually teach this to regular people?
Oh, that's a great question.
We're talking about 7th century Arabia, not a modern university seminar. And there's a story in the historical traditions that is just incredibly cinematic, and it answers this exact question.
You are referring to the Battle of the Camel.
Yes. You have to picture the scene. Swords are clashing, horses are screaming, sand is flying everywhere. It is a literal chaotic war zone.
Pure chaos.
And in the dead middle of this battle, a Bedouin man pushes his way through the ranks, walks right up to Ali and asks him a philosophical question. He says, "Is God one?"
Right in the middle of a war.
Yes. Huh? And Ali's own people are furious. They try to shoo the guy away, yelling, "Are you kidding me? Look around. The man is preoccupied with a war."
Naturally.
But Ali stops them. He insists on answering the question right then and there. He tells them that this deep theology, this exact precise understanding of Tawhid, is the very thing they are fighting for.
It is a profound historical moment. Ali effectively turns a battlefield into a classroom.
Yeah.
And in the middle of that chaos, he breaks down four different classes of the word one. He explains that two definitions are completely invalid when applied to God, and two are valid.
Let's take our time and unpack the invalid ones first. Why can't we just say God is one and leave it at that?
Well, the first invalid use is treating God as one in a numerical series.
Yeah.
He is not the number one sitting in a sequence where there could theoretically be a number two or a number three.
Right, because pure existence has no second.
Exactly, as we established earlier. Now, the second invalid use is calling him one as a species of a genus.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning you cannot say he is one God among gods the way you would say someone is one human among humans or one horse among horses.
Okay, that makes sense.
Categorizing him like that implies he shares a likeness or a structural framework with other beings. It limits him to a category.
Okay, so numbers are out and categories are out.
Mm-hmm.
What are the two valid ways Ali says we can call God one?
The first valid definition is that he is unique, meaning utterly without parallel or peer among things. He is a reality unto himself.
And the second?
The second valid definition is that he is indivisible. He admits of no division whatsoever, not in physical reality, not in intellectual breakdown, and not even in your imagination. You cannot mentally slice him into parts.
But there's a paradox here that I want to bring up. Later in the historical text, there's a quote from Imam al-Sadiq where he's replying to a heretic, and he says of God, he is a thing, but unlike other things.
Ah, yeah.
My question is, why use the word thing at all? If he breaks the mold of literally everything else in existence, doesn't calling him a thing just drag him back down into our worldly categories and confuse the issue?
It sounds like a contradiction on the surface, I agree. But if we analyze what the Imam is trying to accomplish pedagogically, it's brilliant.
How so?
By calling him a thing, but unlike other things, he prevents God from becoming an empty, meaningless word. If you just tell people God is not a thing, you risk nullifying him entirely in the minds of your listeners.
Oh, I see. They might think it's a metaphor.
Right. They might walk away thinking God is just a metaphor or a void or some abstract feeling.
So it's a guardrail against nihilism.
Yes. By adding, unlike other things, he immediately throws up a second guardrail to stop us from putting God into a category with creatures. He affirms that God is a concrete reality without affirming any limitation.
That is a razor-thin tightrope to walk.
It really is.
Which leads us perfectly into the next major question. If God isn't a countable object out there, and he isn't a thing like the things we know, where is he relative to us right now?
Yeah, the concept of presence.
Right. This text explores the concepts of mixture, shadows, and veils, and it brings in a kind of theological map from Imam Al-Rida.
And Imam Al-Rida maps this out using paired clauses that are designed to short-circuit our normal assumptions. He says God is manifest, but not in a physical sense that you can touch or bump into.
Okay.
He is self-disclosing, but not in a way you can see with your optical eyes. And he is hidden, but not in the spatial sense of being separate or far away from things.
This directly ties into what the tradition calls the negation of attributes.
It does. The perfection of Tawhid, according to Ali, is negating attributes from God. Not in the sense that God is an empty shell, but rejecting the human idea that his attributes are separate, distinct features bolted onto his essence.
Oh, so they aren't separate parts.
Exactly. His knowledge is his power, and his power is his existence. The tradition further explains this by talking about the creation of the greatest name.
The idea that the names flow downward.
Right.
From three hidden pillars down to 12 and then out to 360.
Yes. The names themselves are posterior. They are created interfaces. They are the branches that reach down into our reality so we can interact with the divine, but they are not the root essence itself.
I want to bring in another analogy from the notes here. This one from Imam al-Bakir. Regarding shadows, it really helped me visualize this relationship.
Go for it.
He asks, have you ever looked at your shadow on a sunny day? A shadow is something. You can point to it. It moves when you move. But it isn't a thing in its own independent right. If you take away the body casting it, the shadow completely and instantly vanishes. So are we the shadows?
That is an incredibly accurate way to understand it based on the text. God gives us our subsistence through what the philosophers call quiddities.
Whoa, time out. Quiddities is a heavy $10 academic word. What are we actually talking about when we say that?
Fair point, yeah. Let's translate that real quick. A quiddity is just the whatness of a thing. It's the form, the definition, the shape, the shadow itself.
Okay, the whatness.
Right. God manifests his existence under the guise of these various forms, these quiddities, but in his own essence, he has no shape or determination.
Which gives profound meaning to Ali's famous line, he is within things, but not by mixture, outside them, but not by separation. He is within the shadow by giving it existence, but he isn't mixed into the shadow's shape.
You've hit the nail on the head. And when Imam Al-Kazim talks about this relationship, he says something truly staggering.
What's that?
He says the only veil between God and creation is the creation itself.
Wait, unpack that for me. We usually think of a veil as a curtain in a dark room. You know, something opaque that hides whatever's behind it. How can the creation be the veil?
Because the text is arguing that God isn't hidden by darkness or a physical barrier. He is hidden by the sheer, overwhelming overpresence of his light.
Overpresence, wow.
Yeah. The reality of his pure existence is so intense, so unbounded, that our finite, limited, shadow-like existence cannot handle it. We can only register it in tiny, shattered fragments.
And those fragments are us.
Those fragments are what we call things or creation. We look at the fragments and we think, this is reality. This is all there is. And so the fragments themselves become the veil that hides the total light.
We are blinded by the white, not by the dark.
Precisely. The sheer intensity of the presence is what makes it invisible to a limited eye.
This brings it all back to the ultimate takeaway of the text. In the final section of this treatise, L.A.H. Tabatabai makes a massive historical claim about where Islam fits into the broader history of human thought.
He does. He claims that while previous philosophical traditions, like the ancient Greeks, or even earlier monotheistic frameworks, successfully reached the idea that God has all perfections, they ultimately stopped there.
Meaning they hit a wall.
Yeah, they reached the concept of the necessary existent with all the best attributes.
But he argues that Islam's absolute tawhid pushes past that boundary. It insists that God is beyond even the determination of perfection. Because as we discussed with the sticky notes, to call something perfect is still to apply a human concept to it.
Exactly. Absolute Tawhid shatters even that final conceptual idol.
It demands that we let go of every mental construct when approaching the divine essence.
Everything.
And that brings me to the perfect wrap-up for this deep dive. At the very end of the text, there is a hadith that sounds incredibly scandalous the first time you hear it, especially after everything we've just talked about.
Oh, I know the one.
It says, whoever asks about Tawhid is ignorant, and whoever answers him is a polytheist.
It sounds like a total rejection of the entire philosophical journey we just took.
It really does. But when you understand the architecture of what we've just built, it makes total sense. Asking the question assumes you can fit God into a neat little verbal definition.
Right.
And giving an answer assumes you can trap him in human words. Words limit things, and limiting God is the very definition of polytheism in this framework.
The language always fails, but the reality remains. We use the words to point beyond the words.
So we've journeyed through the illusion of the sophist, the sticky notes of our human concepts, the arrows flying at the battle of the camel, and the blinding light of the veil of creation. I want to leave you, the learner, with a final thought to mull over today as you step away from this audio and go about your life.
Mm-hmm.
If all human language ultimately fails to capture this absolute reality, and if the only veil separating you from God is actually you, how does that change the way you look in the mirror today? Or how you view the passing shadows of the world walking around you?
A profound question to end on.
Until next time, keep digging into the foundations.